So I switch to English again, like we did before. If I would be British or American, I would be forced to start with some witty joke, some anecdote, or whatever. But thanks God, I'm just a very boring German. So I stick to the very cruel but very common German habit of the so-called preliminary remark. So let me just make a couple of very short remarks. My first remark is I was asked by the organizers to talk English, and my little warning is my relation to the English language is somehow like my relation to my wife. I love her, but I can't control her all the time. So so be nice to me if I'm not able to really speak fair German, I hope I can speak. The second remark is a big thank you to the organizers. They do not entirely know, and you just mentioned it, what big favor they're doing to me, because it gives me the wonderful opportunity not only to meet friends from Israel, but to fight my homesickness, which I really have when it comes to Israel and the Holy Land. But I would also like to give the compliment to you that organizing such things, and especially the exchange, is very important, because there's one thing that I really experienced during my time in Israel, and that is that there was a disturbingly high level of superficiality in Germany when it comes to Israel and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And I still sense that superficiality, a superficiality that is sometimes really fatally combined with yet the will to take up a clear position. Even though you don't know, you pretend to know. And I think there is no obligation out of the Shoah not to criticize Israel. And by the way, I have not experienced any Israeli saying that we would not be allowed to criticize. But I think we have the, excuse my French, damn obligation to inform ourselves about what's going on. And I think this is why this exchange is a very, very important thing, and the conference like this is too. The third remark is this event is also kind of, that's my very personal remark, of a déjà vu for me, because one of the last events I was actually hosting in Jerusalem in June 2017 was a cooperation between the Adenauer Stiftung in Israel and the Bundeszentrale. It was the presentation of the newest book of the Bundeszentrale, the very big book of Gisela Dax about Israel. I can just recommend that book, it's fabulous. Thanks, by the way, to the charming way in which Anita gently pressured me not only to do that, but also to come today. My fourth remark is that I'm very thankful about both representatives, because they are also representing a partner which we worked with for a long time, the Geneva Initiative, and the Palestinian branch, the Palestinian Peace Coalition. I think that this partner and this institution is a very important institution. And this brings me now to our highly esteemed guests. A very warm welcome to Ron Schatzberg. Let me just... introduce him. He studied journalism and political science at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. He is a reserve officer of the Israeli Defense Forces in the ranks of a colonel. Since 1999, he is a senior advisor at the Economic Cooperation Foundation, an Israeli think tank that had a crucial part also in launching the Oslo process. His work is dedicated to resolving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. So his work never ends, it seems. He's also a specialist on Jordanian-Israeli relations, as well as on cross-border cooperation, and we come to that later. He's also advising the Israeli Defense Forces on issues like laws of armed conflict, and he's working as a counselor to the international community of the Red Cross concerning also questions of international humanitarian law. He was a very reliable and very good partner during my time in Israel, and this is why I'm very happy to see you, Ron. Again, a very big welcome to you. And equally... you have your fans here, it seems.
I work very hard for
them. I guess. An equally warm welcome goes to Suleiman Aboudaye. I hope that I didn't spoil your name totally. Okay. He was born in Beit Jalla, which is, all of you know, next to Bethlehem. He has very strong ties to Germany, as he studied social science at the Ruhr University in Bochum, and he did also study economics at the universities of Bonn. wonderful university, by the way, and Bremen. He worked for the Deutsche Stiftung für internationale Entwicklung, which is today, I think, a part of the GIZ. After that, he worked as the head of the German desk at the Near East Tourist Agency in Jerusalem. Finally, he joined our dear colleagues at the Friedrich Naumann Stiftung für die Freiheit, the office in Jerusalem. As the Adenauer guy, I might say, well, nobody's perfect. But at the Naumann Stiftung, he is responsible for the Palestinian issues in the office of the foundation in Jerusalem. He is, I think this is very important for this audience, since almost 14 years, the country coordinator for the Bundeszentrale in the Palestinian territories. As I already, yeah, that... That deserves an applause. As I already mentioned, he's a very active member of the Palestinian Peace Coalition, the branch of the Geneva Initiative. Since the mid-90s, he's engaged as political and civil society expert and activist in the Palestinian-Israeli dialogue on different levels in the country and abroad. He is, I think this also, this secret we can reveal, he is married to the current representative of the PA to the Federal Republic of Germany, and former PA Minister for Tourism, Kulut Daibes, so he's also an insider when it comes to, probably, when it comes to the PA. Welcome to this panel, Mr. Abu Daye. It seems that the organizers left the most complicated question to us, which is, so to say, the $1 million question. Can there be a realistic solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict? What might be the role models for this solution? What are the trends? What is the current situation like? What can be done? Well, I'm pretty aware that that I'm just the moderator, but the organizers committed the big mistake to ask me to give a short introduction. Just a couple of remarks. And being a professional wisecrack, I gladly accepted this, this challenge. I would just point out six, seven very short trends that I think are very important as, let's say, the frame for what we are actually discussing, the solution, the possible solution to the conflict. First trend is that we, of course, have to see that there is declining support, or let us be more precise, like Tom Segev did yesterday, there is declining a declining feeling of probability for the two-state solution. Since almost a decade already, last polls conducted by the Steinmetz Center and the Palestine Center for Policy and Survey Research and other polls that we have also been involved in show that only a minority of both Israeli Jews and Palestinians, 43% roughly each, support the concept of a two-state solution. And this dropped 8 and 9 points since 2016, 9 points. It seems at least, is this the explanation of some of the pollsters like Khalid Shikaki, that this dramatic decline also has to do with Trump's announcement to launch the deal of the century. But we can discuss that later. The second trend, what are the biggest obstacles to a negotiated peace agreement? In a poll that we did together with the Palestine Center for Policy and Survey Research, the Palestinian Nolde Neumann, if you want, Khalid Shikaki, and the Israeli Democracy Institute, it was quite interesting to see what has been perceived by the Israeli and Palestinian public to be the biggest obstacle. So we asked, where would you be willing to make concessions in case there might be a negotiated peace agreement? The settlements are a big obstacle to peace, of course, but a majority would be willing to make concessions here on both sides. A majority of Palestinians would say, if there is peace, we solve this issue. Besides the Israeli demand of a total Palestinian demilitarization and the Palestinian demand to receive at least some compensation and acknowledgement of the refugee issue, in which either side would not be willing to really move ahead, there is the one big problem where both sides would hardly make the slightest concession, and that is the final status of Jerusalem. Jerusalem and its future seems like it was in all negotiations still and unfortunately increasingly to be the one obstacle to peace. Due to that, it might be important to avoid any kind of further religious charging of the conflict in Jerusalem. So for the last decade, it seemed that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict was mainly a territorial conflict with some religious dimensions. What would happen if it would become a religious conflict with some territorial dimensions, it would make the conflict almost unsolvable. But Jerusalem is not only an Israeli-Palestinian theater. Here we will see the third important current trend, which I would like to point out, and which is hardly is being seen in Germany. It's the Jordanian component. This is because of the simple fact that the King of Jordan plays the role of what one could call the Lord Protector of the Temple Mount. And that's embodied in the peace agreement between Jordan and Israel. I'm sure that nobody in this room will deny how important the peace with Jordan is for the security of Israel. But the recent developments show that the king is obviously under huge pressure. So whoever ignites fire on the Temple Mount might also set the Jordanian king on fire. And this leads directly to the fourth trend, and I'm finishing soon, and then we discuss the dramatic change of the regional environment around Israel, which includes the fragile situation in the north and the risk of any overspill of the civil war in Syria or the impact of Hezbollah. We have been talking about that in the prior panel, but which also includes the new rapprochement between the Arab countries and Israel in the wake of the Saudi-Iran dispute. This puts the question on the table, and this is why I'm mentioning that, if there would not possibly also be the revival of a regional track to peace. The fifth dimension is the question, what can be done if the two-state solution does not seem to be so very viable anymore? Just a continuation of the status quo? Or could any other strategy be applied? What about the strategy of small steps? It seems, and this is also clearly visible in the polls, that large majorities on both sides believe the other side is untrustworthy. The alienation between both parts is deepening dramatically, and I think this is something that we should talk about too. This is also why all dialogue between activists on either side seems to be increasingly important. This is why I'm so much endorsing the Geneva initiative. To show that there is room for the small steps strategy is that if we look at the water issue, Jill just pointed out, there is also some progress. The reestablishment of the Joint Israeli-Palestinian Water Commission is one example for that, even though the work is complicated, but that's a progress. We see equal progress, very first seeds have been planted in the field of the digital economy, and also if that is another issue, of course, also the security cooperation, despite the fact that it's on and off, still is very important. But can this path really lead to peace? Question mark. The sixth trend is the changing role of the international environment and the question who can serve as an honest broker. Also here the polls show a clear dilemma. Being asked who might play the role of an honest broker, the equation looks like this. On the Palestinian side, the UN and the EU are being regarded to be possible honest brokers. The US, clearly not. On the Israeli side, the US is clearly being regarded to be an honest broker, especially since Trump. But the UN and the EU, clearly not. So if you put a line under that, nothing is left. There is something like a mismatch. And also a peace deal, the deal of the century being brought by Donald Trump and his son-in-law to the Middle East arena might not bridge this mismatch. And the seventh and final trend I would like to point out before we discuss here is, of course, the domestic political situation in the respective entities. Who will be the future ruler in the PA? And will the Israeli government continue to work, or will we have elections? What's going on in the moment, and what will be the impact on whatever would be regarded to be a track to peace? Well, a hell lot of trends, a lot of questions, but the good thing is that the organizers just asked me to ask the questions, but not to give the answers. Fortunately, we have two experts, two activists here who are trying both, and I think this is also something that should be acknowledged, trying both to keep channels open for a negotiated peace agreement, and who are now willing to discuss these issues with us. I suggest that we do like we did before, we discuss up here a little bit, and then we open to you. I just described a couple of the obstacles. What is your perspective? What are the biggest obstacles to a peace process? And what concessions, in this case, on the side also of the Palestinians, would the public be willing to make?
Uh,
Einfach reinsprechen.
Ist es schon an?
Nur reinsprechen, schon
okay,
an.
Okay, ist an. Können Sie mich hören? Okay. Ich spreche jetzt mal Deutsch. Ja? Ja, wenn Sie mir erlauben, ich würde mal Deutsch sprechen. Ausnahmsweise, ja. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass mein Deutsch vielleicht etwas besser als mein Englisch und ich fühle mich eher zu Hause im Deutschen als im Englischen. Ich zolle Ihnen auch Respekt. Ich bin immerhin vor einem deutschen Publikum. Deswegen muss ich vielleicht auch Deutsch sprechen. So, was sind die wichtigsten Hindernisse? Vielleicht manche Leute würden meinen, das ist vielleicht die Jerusalemer Frage. Andere könnten sagen, das ist die Flüchtlingsfrage oder die Siedlungsfrage. Oder vielleicht auch die Akzeptanz Israels als ein Staat, ein normaler Staat in der Region. All das ist, glaube ich, nicht großes Hindernis. Das sind Hindernisse, aber nicht die großen Hindernisse. Ich glaube, das größte Hindernis, warum wir bisher keinen Frieden erreichen konnten, dass die Israelis bisher die Palästinenser nicht auf gleicher Ebene behandelt und angesehen haben. Die Israelis erkennen bisher nicht ohne Einschränkung das Recht der Palästinenser auf einen Nationalstaat. Und sie erkennen nicht ohne Einschränkung ihr Recht auf Selbstbestimmung, was sie lange Zeit für sich gefordert haben. Das ist eine sehr bedauerliche, eine sehr problematische Einstellung. Und ich glaube, wenn das nicht sich geändert hat, wenn die politische Elite Israels dies nicht ohne Wenn und Aber anerkannt, werden wir noch hunderte von Jahren miteinander verhandeln oder eben Kriege führen, was ich nicht hoffe. Aber sobald dieses Recht anerkannt ist, halte ich alle anderen strittigen Fragen für lösbar. Beide Seiten müssen Kompromisse machen und ich finde die Palästinenser, indem sie die Osloer Deklaration akzeptiert haben, indem sie auch der Staat Israel in seiner Grenzen von 67 anerkannt haben, haben sie bereits im Vorfeld eigentlich einen historischen Kompromiss akzeptiert, indem sie auf 78% ihrer ursprünglichen Heimat verzichtet haben, zugunsten des Staates Israel, und indem sie sich bereit gefunden haben, für eine Übergangszeit von 5 Jahren eine temporäre Lösung zu akzeptieren, in der sozusagen die palästinensische Autorität eingerichtet wurde und dann am Ende dieser 5-jährigen Temporary Period dann vielleicht ihren Staat auszurufen. Indem man dies getan hat, finde ich, dass die Palästinenser durchaus eins, was für sie lange Zeit unvorstellbar gewesen ist, einen historischen Kompromiss akzeptiert haben, indem sie bereit waren, Jerusalem zu teilen, indem sie bereit waren, das Land mit den Juden sozusagen zu teilen, indem sie bereit waren, ganz normale, ganz friedliche Beziehungen mit dem Staat Israel zu akzeptieren, indem sie auch bereit waren, ihr Land als entmilitarisiert zu akzeptieren. Insofern eine ganze Reihe von israelischen Forderungen haben sie schon im Vorfeld eines Friedensvertrages akzeptiert. Jetzt, wenn von den Palästinensern verlangt wird, dass sie Konzessionen machen, ich frage mich, worauf beziehen sich diese Leute? Was wollen sie, dass die Palästinenser noch mehr darauf verzichten? Sollen sie eben auf Außengrenzen verzichten? Sollen sie auf die Souveränität über ihr Territorium verzichten? Sollen sie auf ihr Wasserreichtum verzichten, wenn man überhaupt von einem Reichtum sprechen kann? Von den wenigen Wasserressourcen, die man hat, soll man darauf verzichten? Ich wüsste nicht, was man sonst auch noch eigentlich einbringen muss, um die Israelis davon zu überzeugen, dass am Ende wir dazu verdammt sind, miteinander auszukommen. Wir haben keinen anderen Weg, außer friedlich nebeneinander und miteinander nicht nur zu leben, sondern zu kooperieren und zusammenzuarbeiten. Das ist sehr schwierig, ohne dass man das, ohne dass man das Selbstverständnis der Palästinenser versteht, was es heißt, auf ihre historische Heimat zu verzichten. Die Juden haben 2000 Jahre ihre Heimat nicht vergessen. Dann kann man doch von den Palästinensern nicht erwarten, dass sie nach 70 Jahren ihre Heimat vergessen. Zumal ja der Staat Israel zu ihnen gekommen ist und sie sind nicht zum Staat Israel eingewandert. Der Staat Israel hat sich eingeladen zu ihnen. Sie haben das am Anfang zwar nicht ganz so mit Begeisterung akzeptiert, sie haben versucht, dagegen auch mit Gewalt vorzugehen, aber am Ende, was auch vernünftig ist, haben sie den Staat Israel akzeptiert. Und ich finde, eine Mehrheit der Palästinenser akzeptiert auch den Staat Israel. Vielleicht die meisten von ihnen nicht freiwillig, aber sie sind, wenn man das deutsche Wort benutzt, Realpolitiker geworden, indem sie akzeptiert haben, verstanden haben, dass man den Staat Israel nicht mehr sozusagen von dieser Region wegträumen kann. Ja? Der Staat Israel ist da, der wird weiterhin bestehen. Und ich finde es okay, dass es auch da ist.
Let me being the kind of the referee here, let me play a little bit, maybe that's expected, to play the advocatus diaboli for a minute. Ron was part of the, I just pointed out that your institution was part of the Oslo track, so to say. And of course, you wouldn't say that Oslo wasn't worth doing it. But Gil, in the previous panel, just alluded to the widespread emotion that you would also find among moderate Israelis, moderate in terms of the peace process, who would say we made in the wake of the Oslo process quite a number of concessions. We gave autonomy. The prime minister went quite far with what he was actually doing. And what we got in exchange was the second intifada, was rockets coming from Gaza. And still, of course, identity is the crucial question. But the question also is, if you look at the polls, there's still a significant number of people on the Palestinian side, besides those who acknowledge, you are right, the right to exist of Israel, but there's a portion of almost 30% saying, well, there's no right to exist. And there's even a portion of 7-8% saying, well, it should be pushed to the sea. So what about that? What is your take on that, Ron? Do you agree to Suleiman?
First of all, I would like to thank you, the organizers, for inviting me, and I would like to thank the BPB for, I think, decades of visits to Israel. I was lucky to participate in some of them, but I think that the program that you put together every year is one of the most comprehensive, and I think that's very important. I would like to think that, to start and say that the main three enemies we have for this, and we current experience for this kind for this conflict, is three things: despair, indifference, and fatigue. And that's what we face here, and that's what we hear all the time from the different speakers along these two days. And I think that the enemies we have to fight: Israelis and Palestinians. The indifference, the fatigue from the peace process, the despair for the feeling of despair of the potential or the options of reaching an understanding, and I think that's not the case. I think we are lacking. I mean, if you ask me about obstacles, the three main obstacles are leadership, leadership, and leadership, on both sides, on both accounts. And I think if a leader in the right scale, on both sides, leaders on both sides of the right scale, they would change the realities. And it's not impossible. And all these polls and all this data about support for the two-state, it will evaporate because someone will lead the way, someone will put the aim on the horizon and will lead the people. I'm not saying it's going to be easy. It's not an easy track. We have 100 years of conflict to solve. It's not only national conflict. It becomes more and more deteriorated into more religious conflict. And for me, that's the first thing that I would say. Next thing I would say that we have we have in Israel, I will relate to Israel, we see the strengthening of the right wing camp. We see more religiousness, we see more national religious, I would say, trends, and demography also speaks. So we are going steadily and gradually towards more right-wing support on Israeli politics. That makes the, I would say, the peace process, it's one of the main obstacles for that. So the sociological aspects or development in the Israeli arena is not of easy, and having saying that, I still think that also moderate center-right will vote for, in the right deal, will vote for a peace process, for a peace solution. I would say that this phenomena of sociological trends in Israel would make the territorial or the peace agreement more difficult to achieve. But if you look at the numbers, you can see that center right and center left and left is enough with the Arab population. It's enough to, with the right deal, to reach understanding. If you ask about the, I would say, hidden trend or hidden, I would say, obstacle that no one speaks no one speaks enough about it, is the whole issue of Temple Mount.
Yes.
Now, Temple Mount is the most sensitive point in the world, I think. It's the volcano of the Middle East, the volcano of the world. If something goes wrong on the Temple Mount, it will be felt anywhere in the world. And I think that we have a growing number of Israelis that see the Temple Mount as part of the national struggle, which means that puts this very sensitive point, maybe not this year, maybe in 5 years, in the heart of the potential conflict, that if something goes wrong there, it's going to be very difficult for all of us to recover. I think that in a way, there's a mirror image of the despair we see in the Palestinian side and the despair we see in the Israeli side. And we have the responsibility as people, as societies, to get out of this state of mind. There's not enough partners that do this kind of effort. There are, on both societies. The anti-normalization movement within the Palestinian side is making a lot of difficulties. Our side also become more and more difficult to say to those who believe in two-state solution, or to those who want to actively support it and actively promote it. It becomes more and more difficult to say and to speak our minds. And there's a general sentiment of non-tolerance on both societies that is very worrying trend that I think that we need to tackle. The religion aspect, I would say, is one of the most fearing obstacles for me, and we see it in both societies. We see it in many areas in our public life, that religiousness, the religious aspect is becoming more strong, and that's, I would say, one of the most hidden obstacles that will make the life of those who promote peace and peace agreement much more difficult. And bear in mind that both societies, both governments, promised their constituency referendum on a final deal, which is makes it even more complicated. I'm not sure we can pass a referendum both. Even if we get the best deal, both in the Palestinian side and the Israeli side, I'm not sure. No doubt that the referendum will give more legitimacy to any deal. The question whether it's the right tool to make decisions. In the last rounds of referendums in the world, it proved to be a very problematic tool. So that's my list of obstacles.
Well, if you've been talking about leadership, of course, I already told you that we can't spare out the question of what's going to happen on the side of the PA. Well, it's not mean to say, and it's not totally unlikely that the time of the government of Abbas is coming to an end sooner or later. So, but what's going to happen then? It seems that there has been, if intentionally or not, created something like an upcoming vacuum. Who's going to be it? Who is it? Ismail Haniyeh, which then would put Hamas in the first place. Marwan Barghouti. What's going to happen there? When I came to the Holy Land, the already quoted Khalil Shikaki said a wonderful sentence to me. He looked deep in my eyes and said, the number one enemy of Fatah is not Israel, it's Hamas. And the number one enemy of Hamas is not Israel, it's Fatah. And he said that very serious. And I mean, he's researching the public feelings. So what's gonna happen? And what would happen, and this doesn't seem totally far-fetched, if Hamas would win elections, would that be the end of all peace aspirations, or what's going to happen in that case?
Erstens glaube ich nicht, dass Hamas bei den nächsten Wahlen die Mehrheit gewinnen wird. Ich glaube, es gibt noch eine große Mehrheit unter den Palästinensern, die sich eine Hamas-Regierung nicht vorstellen kann und dass sie auch nicht in der Lage sein wird, den Konflikt mit Israel sozusagen zu lösen. Und erst recht wird eine Hamas-Regierung nicht überall, weder in der regionalen Kontext noch im internationalen Kontext akzeptiert sein. Ich glaube, auch Hamas ist inzwischen vernünftiger geworden, dass sie auch nicht unbedingt die Regierungsmacht anstrebt. Hamas ist dann froh, wenn sie einen Einfluss auf die palästinensische Politik hat, aber nicht unbedingt jetzt die volle Verantwortung zu übernehmen. Sie haben die Erfahrung zwischen 2006 und 2007, als die Wahlen gewonnen haben, dass sie vollkommen isoliert waren. Sie waren nicht nur international isoliert, auch nicht nur regional, auch innerpalästinensisch waren sie isoliert. Diese Regierung war nicht unbedingt von der Mehrheit der Palästinenser getragen. Und auch die Mehrheit der Palästinenser hat die Hamas die Stimme gegeben. Nicht, weil sie von Hamas überzeugt sind. Sie wollten eigentlich Fatah für ihre Politik bestrafen. Das ist der Grund, warum eben Hamas eine Mehrheit gewonnen hat. So dass ich nicht glaube, dass Hamas erstmal bereit ist und in der Lage ist, die Geschäfte in den palästinensischen Gebieten zu übernehmen. Das größere Problem ist, dass Fatah nicht in der Lage eigentlich ist, sich auf eine Führungspersönlichkeit zu einigen. Fatah ist in sich gestritten. Es gibt eine ganze Reihe von Fraktionen, Machtgruppen und Machtzentren innerhalb der Fatah. Und es gibt kaum eine Persönlichkeit, die unumstrittene sozusagen Führungspersönlichkeit innerhalb der Fatah gewinnen kann. Im Übrigen, wenn es überhaupt eine Persönlichkeit in der Lage ist, tatsächlich Abbas zu folgen in der Macht, dann ist es unbedingt ein Mann von der Fatah, sicherlich nicht von irgendeiner anderen. Eine andere Fraktion oder Organisation, selbst ein Salam Fayyad, der lange Zeit der Ministerpräsident gewesen ist, der auch international und regional akzeptierte Persönlichkeit, ist ein ökonomischer Experte, der ist weitsichtig, der ist moderat, er kann durchaus integrativ wirken innerhalb der palästinensischen Gesellschaft, selbst er ist nicht in der Lage, sich durchzusetzen gegenüber irgendeiner Persönlichkeit von der Fatah. Insofern, die nächste Person wird eine Fatah-Führungspersönlichkeit sein. Die Frage ist, wer diese Person. Nach meinem Verständnis, nach meiner Beobachtung, es gibt nur eine einzige Person, auf die sich Fatah einigen kann, aber auch selbst von der Hamas und von den anderen Fraktionen akzeptiert werden kann. Und das ist Marwan Barghouti, der zurzeit im israelischen Gefängnis sitzt, seit 2002, und der, glaube ich, fünf lebenslänglich und nochmal 144 Jahre zu sitzen hat im israelischen Gefängnis. Und das ist die einzige Person, die theoretisch in der Lage sein könnte, die Nachfolge von Abbas anzutreten. Alle anderen Personen sind umstritten, sind nicht unbedingt integrativ genug, aber irgendjemand, wenn Marwan nicht zum Zuge kommt, wird irgendeine Persönlichkeit von der Fatah sein. Ich glaube nicht Saeb Erekat, aber ich glaube vielleicht einer von diesen Sicherheitsleuten wie Jibril Rjoub oder vielleicht Hussein Sheikh oder Mohammed Steyer, das sind Namen, die Ihnen wahrscheinlich nicht allzu viel sagen, aber das sind alle Mitglieder des Zentralkomitees der Fatah und sie sind auch zum Teil Mitglieder des Exekutivkomitees der PLO. Und das sind die drei stärksten, ich würde mal sagen, Persönlichkeiten. Aber die Frage ist, was kann diese neue Person eigentlich Neues für die Israelis bringen? Im Jahre 2005, als Abbas als Präsident gewählt wurde, waren die Israelis sehr froh darüber. Sie haben gesagt, das ist der Mann, mit dem wir unser Frieden schließen können. Der ist genau das Gegenteil von Arafat. Der ist nicht ein Mann der bewaffneten sozusagen Widerstandes. Der war niemals der Mann, der für Gewalttätigkeit plädiert hat. Er war ein Mann des Friedens, der hat immer von einem Ausgleich mit Israel gesprochen. Er war die ideale Person eigentlich, um mit ihm letztendlich in Frieden zu schließen. Aber was hat man mit ihm gemacht? Er hat jede Art von Vertrauen verloren unter den Palästinensern, weil er über 12 Jahre lang und noch länger nichts liefern konnte. Die Lebensumstände der Palästinenser haben sich nicht unbedingt verbessert. Die ökonomische Situation hat sich nicht verbessert. Die Bewegungsfreiheit von den Palästinensern ist eingeschränkt geblieben. Ganz im Gegenteil, der Prozess der Besiedlung der palästinensischen Gebiete ist fortgeführt worden. Die Einschränkung der Menschen in Jerusalem und der Prozess der Aussondierung mehr und mehr Palästinenser aus Ost-Jerusalem ist vorangeschritten worden. Es gab nicht ein einziges Anzeichen, was Abbas gegeben wurde, um eben Vertrauen unter den Palästinensern zu gewinnen. Somit ist er eigentlich der Mann des Versagens und des Scheiterns. So dass ich nicht glaube, dass irgendeine andere Persönlichkeit in der Lage sein wird, mehr zu erreichen, als Abbas nicht in der Lage war zu erreichen, wenn die Israelis dies nicht möglich machen. Jeder Erfolg einer palästinensischen Persönlichkeit oder Präsidenten hängt eigentlich von den Konzessionen und von der Dialogbereitschaft der israelischen Seite. Aber wir haben das Problem, dass Palästinenser und Israelis unterschiedliche Auffassungen vom Frieden haben. Selbst wenn wir von Zwei-Staaten-Lösung sprechen, Israelis verstehen darunter, ich meine das offizielle Israel. Natürlich gibt es schon manche Israelis, die das vielleicht auch mit uns diese Vorstellung teilen. Aber das powerful Israel versteht unter Zwei-Staaten-Lösung anders, was die Palästinenser darunter verstehen. Insofern ist es in unseren Dialogen miteinander, Israelis und Palästinenser, sehr oft werden wir damit konfrontiert, dass sie von was anderem reden, wenn wir von der Zwei-Staaten-Lösung sprechen. Manche betrachten Ost-Jerusalem nicht unbedingt als Teil eines Kompromisses, dass die Israelis aufgeben müssen, um eben eine Hauptstadt für die Palästinenser dort zu ermöglichen. Oder die Frage der Siedlungen, oder die Frage des Jordan-Tals und so. Es gibt eine ganze Reihe von Fragen, die unter Israelis und Palästinenser umstritten sind. Und wir haben keine Einvernehmlichkeit darüber. Und insofern, wenn Sie miteinander reden, dann müssen Sie auch diese Kernfrage nochmal sozusagen thematisieren und genauer darüber Klarheit sich verschaffen.
Dear Ron, it's also the question of how many advocates are still there. We discussed the changes in the Israeli society. How many advocates are still there for the two-state solution? There's obviously one group which still represents quite a significant part of this advocate, so to say, and that's the commanding officers of the IDF. Generals, colonels, your ranks. Sometimes you have the feeling that this is kind of the last man standing. And the good thing about that is that the voice of those people is still being heard in the public discourse. And I think that's very important. But now we had the case of Ilon Azaria, the guy who was shooting a terrorist who previously committed a knife attack in Hebron and then was shot and then was unable to fight. And then was shot into the head by this member of the army. Is there a shift of paradigm that this draft army, which used to be a mirror of the society, is somehow then changing? what's the role, what's the significance of the IDF in these discussions about two-state solution?
Before answering your question, I want to relate to what Suleiman was saying regarding the agreement. What is the two-state solution on the eyes of the Israelis and Palestinians? I think that there's no one conflict in the world that has more track two, track one negotiations, that everyone knows what are the differences between the sides. It's very clear. I mean, also a lot of work that are ready in the shelf just to take as a good ideas for solution for these. So we know exactly what is the zone of possible agreement between the sides. It just needs the leadership on both sides to lead it, because we exhausted, I think, every avenue of negotiations on all tracks. So we know where the territorial disagreements are, where the disagreements about Jerusalem, what are the disagreements and what are the conditions in the refugees issue, in the water issue, in the borders issue. Everything is known. I mean, since 1999, I'm involved in track two negotiations. I think that I covered specific issues, but all in all the different track two organization or non-governmental organizations, we have a very thick file of this peace agreement, and we know what are the compromises that each side should take. And as I said before, it takes leaders before. Regarding your question, first of all, the army is not a part of the political game. The IDF is very strict with that. Though there was episodes where army generals were sent to be part of the negotiations in the Camp David side, and I think it was a mistake, but that was in the past. Since then, I think the army was wise enough not to engage as an army in the negotiation. Not there was so many negotiation, but if you take the last round of Annapolis process, you didn't have the army in the front lines. You have the planning directorate behind the scenes and as a professional that need to be, but not as chief negotiators like it used to be before. So the army itself is not involved in negotiations. But if you look at the former generals and the majority of the Israeli former generals and brigadiers, and if you look at the last at least 40 years, you see that most of them will belong to center left. This is going through a change, very moderate and very gradual change because of, as I said before, sociological changes in society that resonate in the army, because the army is draft army and it's people's army, so it's a mirror of the Israeli society, and also a mirror of the a very strong group within the Israeli society, the national religious group that targeted these positions of the army and other positions in the legal system and other, to be part of their mobility, to be part of their conviction to change Israel according to what they think should Israel be. And in this regard, you can see quite extensive growth of the number of officers in combat units, in the field units that are, I mean, you look at the officers' course, you see much more national religious people, soldiers and officers, much more than their size of the population. And I'm coming from a kibbutz background, and my successor as chief of staff of my brigade is a settler from an illegal outpost. He's a very good friend of mine. And the three battalion commanders that replaced in my reserve brigade all were kibbutzniks that were replaced by settlers. So that gives you an evidence of the shift of the combat officers in the middle level of the army, and it will go up along the years to the higher level. But having said that, I'm not that worried, because first of all, these people, if you look at very superficially, you say, okay, the right wing religious taking over the army, but most of those army officers, first of all, they are very. We spoke yesterday about mamlachtiyut, those who have the responsibility for the state and see the whole state as and they don't see only their sector, but they are religious. And one of the effects of that you have all your when you are serving in the army and all your commanders are religious, that's who you aspire to. These are your models, and that comes also with sometimes their beliefs and sometimes their political opinion. It is possible to put aside your political opinion, but when you are serving in a territory, when you are challenged, things goes out. And that's part of the thing, because you can see new soldiers, their image of the religious, national religious, their values, you look up to. If you are a soldier, you look up to these guys, and that's have some sort of an effect that I don't know how to measure it, but might be shown in the future. I think that, in a way, the Azaria case was exposing some of the sensitivities in our society. It's not that, it reveals the very big gap between those who... that basically an evidence of the conflict. I mean, there were so many supporters of what he did within the Israeli society, I was shocked. Polls, and not only the social media, but polls also shows that many Israelis thought that what he did, those who doesn't know, a terrorist came to stab a soldier. He was injured by the soldier, and then another soldier, after 5 minutes, when this person was already neutralized, was not a danger to anyone, he just came and shot him and killed him. And then he was trialed, and there was a lot of controversy over the trial, and the kind of support, the popular support, and the leadership, the political support he got, created a sentiment that was contradicting the message of the army. The army was very clear, with a very clear message that was wrong from the minute it happens, and the fact that our different ministers of Israel gave sort of support to the family, to the person. This was a very devastating effect for the army, and the kind of remarks we had from the minister of education, who started to. An attack on the state, not the state attorney, the military chief advocate, I think that's the name. But that was very, very dangerous. It's an evidence of this very dangerous process where you target the army and you target the laws of armed conflict, what you can do, what you can't do. It gets to the moral question of what is the right thing to do, and that's the sad thing that is it revealing the processes that we as a society went through. And I think if you take it 20 years ago, probably this kind of thing would never happen, or this kind of support to such thing would never happen. Those who thought that this was the right thing would not dare to say their mind. Now they dare because there are ministers who say the same. So there's more room for such thinking and such, I would say, even racism. The life of a Palestinian, is a terrorist. If I have no problem of while you are in the process trying to neutralize him, he's killed. That's your aim. You should kill him. But if he's not killed and if he's injured, your duty is to treat him as a human being, and that's the laws of armed conflict, that's the international humanitarian law, that's what you should do. And the fact that this is not accepted in my society is an evidence of the deterioration we face because of 50 years of occupying another people, because this is the price we pay on the national level. We are deteriorating into a more racist country, more racist society, the one that doesn't value the other lives as the same as mine. And this is not the society I want to live in. And some people spoke about yesterday and today that Israel, you know, feeling good of living in this, nothing can shake the boat that we are in. I think that the price we pay on the private level, on the personal level, and I can speak only about myself as a person who served so many years in the territories, occupying, controlling other people's life, there's a price you pay on a personal level, which I don't want my I have two sons who already finished that. I have another two sons that will be coming someday soldiers. I don't want them to pay the same price I paid. I just gave you the national price we pay, becoming more racist society. But on a personal life, on a personal note, or on a personal price you pay, it's a dear price, which I don't want my kids to have. And that's something that need to rock our boat all the time when we think about, okay, we can manage this conflict, like our prime minister say, we can continue this situation. Our economy is thriving. We're living a very good life, but we are not. It's only a facade. Beneath the ground, there's this terrible, I would say, trends that emerging every time. And the Azaria case wasn't one case of this emerging force of racism and bigotry, and that is there. And the leaders, starting from who I said, and also you can join Trump and alike, they give this, I would say, legitimacy to such voices. And that's the most dangerous thing about Trump, in my belief. Trump and people like him. They give legitimacy to the masses to speak this way, to think this way. Think they can think whatever they want, but to speak out loud with the social media and create this kind of notion acceptable. And that's a very sad thing.
Well, we will open soon to you. The last question here up here, because I mean our job description is basically: is there a realistic solution to the conflict? Which of course is the difficult question to make. And there is two components I would like to discuss with you. One is the component of what I just brought into the discussion in the beginning: is the question of a regional track. There is one big thing that we should see, and that's the fact that while the leader of the Sunni countries around Israel might follow a more pragmatic approach when it comes to Israel, it would be naive to think that they would be overly keen on a full normalization with Israel before the conflict between Israelis and Palestinians would be resolved, because they would have a hell of a lot of problems with their own population. And we just had a poll also in Jordan a couple of months ago, where we asked the people in Jordan, how do you perceive the right to exist of Israel? It was about 90% saying, we doubt this right to exist. So there is a big difference between, and you were just pointing out leadership on one hand, but on the other hand, you have the population. So how to bridge that? And that's not only a question, of course, of Jordan and Israel and the Palestinians. So also the question to you would be, both of you, would be how far, if the rapprochement with Israel is fairly important to the elites in Saudi Arabia and other neighboring countries, how far would they go in exerting some kind of pressure on the Palestinian side to come to a peace agreement, because that is imaginable that they would exert some pressure here. And on the other hand, I would also love, besides what I just said, to bring the Jordanian case to the table, because you are also an expert on Jordanian-Israeli relations. What's going to happen here? There has been also the rumor of kind of establishing a Jordanian-Israeli-Palestinian confederation. I would say maybe that's the third or fourth or fifth step before doing the first step, and that would be making peace. And then you can talk about confederation. But what is the role of Jordan in that regard, and how important, also how disturbing is the current, let's say, alienation between the two? So.
Ja, wenn ich mal beginnen darf. Also zunächst will ich mal feststellen, dass der arabisch-israelische Konflikt ist eigentlich eine Folgeerscheinung des israelisch-palästinensischen Konfliktes. Historisch gesehen haben eigentlich Araber und Moslems generell mit Juden kein Problem. Sie waren mehr oder weniger jahrhundertelang eigentlich Bewohner dieser Gebiete. Damals gab es ja diese Staaten als solche nicht, die Nationalstaaten. Aber sie waren mehr oder weniger genauso wie Kurden oder wie Christen oder wie Drusen oder wie alle anderen Minderheiten in diesem arabisch-islamischen Raum. Sie waren zum Teil benachteiligt, wie eben andere religiöse oder ethnische Minderheiten. Aber sie waren normale, wenn man das so sagen darf, normale Bürger. Sie haben nicht diese in Europa systematische Verfolgung und Isolierung und zuletzt natürlich Vernichtung erlebt. Insofern gibt es keine historische Feindschaft zwischen Juden und Moslems, zwischen Juden und Araber. Ganz im Gegenteil, wer sich mit der Geschichte auskennt, die Juden wurden genauso wie die Araber aus Andalusien vertrieben und sie kamen in arabisch-islamische Länder, die Juden, und die haben dort ihre Heimat wiedergefunden. Insofern, der Konflikt mit den arabischen Staaten ist diese Folgeerscheinung, sodass ich nicht glaube, dass es ein großes Hindernis darstellen wird, die Beziehungen zu den arabischen Staaten zu normalisieren, auch diplomatische Beziehungen aufzunehmen. Zumal die arabischen Staaten im Jahre 2002 die arabische Friedensinitiative vorgeschlagen haben, indem alle 22 arabische Staaten inklusive das damalige Libyen unter Muammar Gaddafi und das damalige Irak unter Saddam Hussein die Normalisierung, die Beziehung mit Israel vorgeschlagen haben, die Aufnahme diplomatischer Beziehungen und die volle Anerkennung Israels angeboten haben. Wenn Israel im Gegenzug das Völkerrecht auf den Palästina-Konflikt anwenden würde, indem sich Israel aus den im Jahr 67 besetzten Gebieten zurückziehen würde und die Etablierung eines palästinensischen Staates ermöglichen würde. Die Reaktion von Sharon war damals, diese Initiative ist nicht mal das Papier wert, auf dem es geschrieben wurde. Im Übrigen, auch Monate danach haben alle islamischen Staaten, 57 islamische Staaten, haben auf der islamischen Konferenz diese Initiative adoptiert und sie waren bereit, der Staat Israel anzuerkennen in den Grenzen von 67. Das ist ein konkretes Angebot gewesen. Wieso hat Israel damals und bis heute diese Initiative nicht aufgegriffen und darauf positiv reagiert? Ich frage mich. Ja. Insofern, ich sehe kein Problem und ich sehe das auch nicht als eine besondere jetzt Entwicklung, dass Israelis und Saudis miteinander reden. Sie haben schon früher geredet. Auch die Beziehung zwischen das Haschimitische Königreich von Jordanien und auch mit der Königsfamilie und Jordanien und mit den israelischen Politikern war ein gutes Verhältnis. Der waren ein wenn man das so im Deutschen sagen will, er war ein Versteher Israel. Ja, die Haschimiten haben durchaus Sympathie für die Pläne der zionistischen Bewegung gehabt. Schon eigentlich in den 20er Jahren. Insofern, das ist auch kein großes Hindernis. Ich glaube nicht, das ist eine besondere jetzt Errungenschaft, dass Netanyahu die Beziehungen so langsam oder die Kontakte mit Oman oder selbst wenn es später mit Bahrain oder Sudan, im Übrigen Sudan steht immer noch eigentlich noch auf der Terrorliste der Amerikaner, aber trotzdem, man strebt eben die Normalisierung der Beziehungen zu Sudan. Das heißt, Politik ist wirklich auch eine Interessenfrage. Ich glaube nicht, dass es ein großes Problem ist, letztendlich die Beziehungen mit den arabischen Staaten zu normalisieren. Aber ich bin davon fest überzeugt, diese Option ist keine tragfähige Option auf Dauer. Wir sehen, der Frieden mit Israel und Ägypten ist seit 1979 sozusagen abgeschlossen worden. Mit Jordanien seit 1994. Und sie haben gerade die Stimmung, sowohl in Jordanien wie auch in anderen arabischen Staaten, ist immer noch nicht sehr freundlich gegenüber Israel. Weil die Araber insgesamt verstehen den Staat Israel immer noch als ein aggressiver Staat, der ein Brudervolk unterdrückt. Sie sehen im Fernsehen, was die israelische Armee in den palästinensischen Gebieten an systematische Verletzung von Menschenrechten von den Palästinensern. Sie können das nicht auf Dauer verdauen und akzeptieren, solange Israel seine Mentalität, sein Besatzungsregime nicht ändert, wird es schwierig sein, die Beziehung zu den arabischen vielleicht Staaten schon, aber nicht zu den arabischen Menschen normalisieren. Und ich denke, letztendlich darauf kommt es an, dass die Völker sich gegenseitig akzeptieren, dass die Araber die Israelis als solche akzeptieren mit einem Existenzrecht, das ohne mit einem Wort in Frage zu stellen. Das ist das Endziel vom Frieden. Das Endziel von Frieden ist nicht, dass der König Abdullah mit dem Netanyahu irgendeinen Friedensvertrag, das wertlos ist, unterschreibt, sondern dass Israel als Staat akzeptiert wird, und zwar von allen Arabern, von allen Moslems. Und dass dieser Staat ein ganz normaler Staat wie alle anderen nahöstlichen Staaten. Wenn wir so weit sind, dann kann ich sagen, es ist um den Frieden sozusagen keine Sorge mehr. Aber wir sind bedauerlicherweise noch weit weg davon. Die Israelis, nach meiner Auffassung, müssen diese Mentalität der Besatzung aufgeben. Ich denke, sie tun sich selber einen Gefallen, wenn sie diese Mentalität aufgeben würden. Weil das ist, wie manche übrigens auch Ron und die Gil und die anderen auch Tom das gesagt haben, dass diese Politik der Besatzung und die Politik der Besser sein, eigentlich die israelische Demokratie erstmal gefährdet, und es produziert keine Mehrheiten in Israel für einen Ausgleich mit den Palästinensern. Und darum geht es. Wie schafft man eine Mehrheit in Israel, die bereit ist, in der Tat einen Ausgleich mit den Palästinensern zu finden, das möglicherweise auch mit dem Verzicht auf Land, nicht nur möglicherweise, ohne Verzicht auf das Land, ohne die Aufgabe der palästinensischen Gebiete nicht möglich ist, nicht denkbar ist. Insofern, man muss realistisch werden, um zu glauben, dass dieses Territorialkompromiss und die Ermöglichung der Gründung eines palästinensischen Staates die wichtigste Voraussetzung dafür, dass die israelischen arabischen Beziehungen und israelisch-islamischen Beziehungen normalisiert werden können.
I would be tempted now to discuss a lot about that. There's also the factor of terror still in the equation, but I refrain from that because time is running. Just a very short, and then we discuss with you.
Okay. First of all, we have to understand that after signing an agreement of peace, there would be 40% of the Israeli population and 40% of the Palestinian population that reject any agreement whatsoever. Yeah. Okay. On top of those two groups, be it Hamas supporters, be it those who believe in Israel, the complete Israel or greater Israel, those will never support the peace agreement, never mind what will be the conditions of this peace. The next one is those who comes from Al-Qaeda or point of view or ISIS point of view or any Salafi point of view who believe that us Jewish people in this sacred land is not accepted. And those will be those who will challenge any future agreement. So we are not talking about, when we talk about a peace agreement, we talk about something that is signed by leaders, but then a very long process of healing need to be started, to begin. And as you said, that's the area of the masses to stop incitement, to start the journey of healing and compromise and reaching out to the other side. And I think in this regard, that's a very long process. But I have no doubt that if we sign agreement with leaders and we don't do this other part, we will never reach where we want to reach. And that's what we have now in Egypt. I mean, no one in Egypt, someone called me and asked me how to assist some Egyptian lecturer to come to Israel. I spoke with the Egyptian-Israeli ambassador to Egypt, and he explained to me the process that the poor citizen from Egypt wants, when he wants to go to visit in Israel, he's going through hell. He will never go. So there no one from Egypt comes to Israel. From Jordan, also, they are really afraid. I'm doing Jordan-Israeli cooperation for the last 15, 16 years. They don't want to stamp their passport in Israel because they will never be able to enter any other Arab country in the world with this. So we have a special arrangement for them to put it on a slip. We do a lot of long process until we give them the visa to visit. It takes some time, 3 months until they will get. It's very hard for our neighbors we have peace with 20, 23 years or 45 years to reach out and visit us. And of course, I didn't mention the reluctancy of those people who wants to visit in Israel because of the incitement, because of the fear of Israelis, because of the all the images of that we have in their eyes. So that's a long process. I have no illusions of, you know, lovey-dovey peace. It's not going to be this way. But we need to start somewhere. And starting is reaching a peace with the Palestinians. And if we want to go, like there was a concept of going from the outside inside that was promoted by the right-wing supporters, which means that you start with peace on the outer rim and then you reach peace with the Palestinians. That will never happen. We understand it. Because the ticket for the region, for Israel, is a peace with the Palestinians. That's understood, and I know that some illusions are promoted by our right-wing leaders, but this is not going to happen. Even if MBS will be very, very, you know, bold, there's a level of what you can do after the Arab Spring in the Arab world. After the Arab Spring, if you are not attentive to the to your constituencies, you will be thrown.
Push away.
And that's something that changed over the years. When Sadat made his move, there was not such fear. He feared because there was the Muslim Arabs, but he was sure. Sorry, the Muslim Brotherhood, but he was sure that he will do it. He could do it. He didn't have to go to referendum. He did what he wants to do, and he changed the history. And I'm not sure now it's very easy for a leader. Going, and by the way, if you remember Camp David, many people don't recall that there was a precondition of autonomy for the Palestinians. He never accepted the peace agreement without taking care what he thought was taking care of the Palestinian problem. Even if it was a token, it was part of the deal, because he had to save face with his own constituencies. Last thing about Jordan, can I have?
Yeah.
So I'll give you one story. Like 10 years ago, Abdel Salam Ajali, who was the prime minister, former prime minister of Jordan, I think he's still alive, he's very old, he came to Israel with a message he said came from late King Hussein. It was a few years after the late King Hussein died. And he said we arranged for a meeting with politicians. He said, a day after you sign an agreement with the Palestinians, I will take care of your main concern. What your main concern? Security. We'll have a confederation, Palestinian-Jordanian confederation, and there will be Jordanian soldiers between the future Palestinian state and Israel. And that's, you can be safe. Because now, which is true, we have a very minimal force along the very long border, 30, 65 kilometers of border between us and the Jordanians. We have a very thin line force because the Jordanians do all the work for us, controlling the border on their side. And they said, okay, you can do it also in future agreement, but confederation, as you hinted, Michael, it's only the second phase. The first phase need to be Israeli establishing of the Palestinian state, and then confederation idea would be very relevant, because I think Palestine need to have for its viability, it needs to have some sort of agreement with the Jordanians, and of course Jordanian interest. Jordan is a keystone in the Middle East, buffering what's going in Syria and Iraq with Israel and with Saudi Arabia. By the way, one of the main concerns of the Jordanians is they don't get the enough support from these two partners that they pay the price for defending them from their point of view. We're controlling the eastern borders of yours, that's your extensive border, and you don't support us. So we do a lot of support and cooperation with the Jordanian army. It's all done in a very low key because of Jordanian needs. The Saudis pay from time to time the debts of the kingdom, but having saying that, the challenges of the kingdom is enormous with the influx of refugees from all kinds, and they have a very big challenge. Last thing about the Arab Peace Initiative or the Saudi Peace Initiative. First of all, bad timing, beginning of the Intifada. No one wanted to, I mean, Sharon was not very keen, but Sharon was preoccupied with dealing with the Intifada. Hundreds of people killed in our streets. So you can understand why the Arab Peace Initiative was not on top of priority. But the problem with the Arab Peace Initiative, and that's what we are trying to fix now, in one of the track two we organized with Gulf states, Jordan and Palestinian and Israelis, is that it came as a dictate. Take it or leave it. It didn't came as, this is our opening position. And there were certain things there that was very problematic to Israel. From refugees, from the peace with Syria, from complete withdrawal from 267 line. And if you take it as a dictate, and that's how it was, it's still a dictate, by the way. It's still take it or leave it, not an opening statement of negotiations. You can understand why the Israeli side is very reluctant to take it. Having saying that, that's a precondition for any future agreement between us and the region. And I think it's a huge development. It's a huge step forward, and it can serve if it will be operationalized and it will be accepted as open statement. And we accept it as an open statement of the other side, but we cannot accept it as is and say, okay, we accept to everything. I know that it was done before once. And those who were with me know that Rabin's letter to commitment for withdrawal from the Golan Heights was a precondition for all future negotiations with the Syrians. But I think in this regard, it's much different. And here we need different approach by the Arab League.
We basically ran out of time now, but I would still allow 2-3 questions, and I would suggest that we put them all together and then we answer them up here. There's the first one here, second one here, and third one here.
Yeah, it's a pity we have so little time, so I try to be short. I have 2 points. The first is, because the water issue arose this afternoon 2 times, I observed that issue during the last 2 decades with the help of the BBP, with various excursions, many thanks for that opinion, and with the students from our technical university in Darmstadt. And I would say the problem is solved for the Israeli side by technical measures, by desalination, cleaning of sewage water, and the energy problem is solved by findings of gas in the eastern Mediterranean. So if you are interested, actually there's an article in print, small article, small journal, if you are interested. My name is Andreas Hoppe. I'm a university professor. And if you look after my name and add geology, you will find me instead a criminal actor. Yeah?
Thank you.
So, and then I can send it to you. The question I have is related to both, because you have addressed that. I remember, and I already asked you that last year, Ron Schatzberg, on our meeting on the hotel in Jerusalem, was after the opinion of your philosopher Leibowitz, and you addressed that you have paid with the occupation a very, very high price in the sense of cost of ownership. And yesterday we learned that Tom Segev is very pessimistic about that the resolution would be possible. Do you think that, for instance, in a time when you have a leader instead of a common politician, that he will be in that actual situation, be able to convince your society that there is a win if you withdraw?
Thank you. Second question. Down here. There, it's waving.
Ja, nochmal Dankeschön für den interessanten Beitrag auf jeden Fall. Ich mache es kurz und knackig. Genau, in vielen angrenzenden Ländern, in arabischen, werden gerade in der Schule und in vielen Kinderserien sehr viele antisemitische Stereotypen reproduziert. Meine Frage ist, inwiefern Sie glauben, beeinflusst das den Friedensprozess oder hat es überhaupt Einfluss, gerade im Hinblick auf die nachfolgenden Generationen?
Thank you. And the last question here. Micro is coming. Yeah, both. We take both. But short, very short.
Yeah, very short. My question is regarding the very first comment that Mr. Abudaya mentioned, which is that we are coming to the negotiating table not as equals, that there is a big difference in, you know, we're not equals. And do you have any idea of what it might take to get us to be equals?
And the last here. Very short, please.
Okay, my name is Wolf, and this will be the shortest question. I need a very short answer. All these presentations today have been taped, but are not for the public because they're just for the people here who went to Israel. This talk you had today, I think, was so inspiring for many people, even who didn't do the visit, that I would like them to put them on my blog. And I just would like an okay from you that you agree that your discussion is going to be published. Thank you.
So now we start with you.
Okay, I will be very brief.
But be brief, please.
Yeah, okay. How do you? First of all, for your question, I have no problem with how a leader will convince the Israeli public in the necessity of peace. It's a very big challenge. I'm not undermining this. Because as it was told, that some people think that's our life, that we are doomed to live on our sword, as it says. But I think that two, if I would say politically, I would say Iran, Iran, Iran. So if this will give us headway with creating some sort of alliance, regional alliance against Iranian involvement and or destabilization efforts in the region, that might be something that Netanyahu can sell to the Netanyahu or any other leader to the public. And maybe we have a poor memory of last 15 years. We didn't have suicide bombers daily on our streets, but you know, because everyone speaks about how good life's in Israel, but only 15 years ago, that's what we had on a daily basis on our streets of our cities. So those who await for the Palestinian to generate another round of violent or to end up in another violent round of violence, that's, I think, a very bad policy. Anti-Semitism, does it influence? We have anti-Semitism embedded and I would say even institutionalized in Arab states, in the TV shows, in newspapers, in characteristics, in anything. That's something that, as I said before, the healing process, it's a long process. I think, unfortunately, a precondition to this healing process is a peace agreement with the Palestinians. I hope it could be different. I hope they could tackle it now. I demand for them to tackle it now, and that's continue to be my demand from the Arab leaders. But unfortunately, I think that's the right order, or that's the only order that could work, and that also will take time. We don't reach the negotiation table as equals. I agree. I mean, it's the nature of where we come from and where we stand, and in our history. Unfortunately, that's the situation. Does it hinder the Palestinian options or limit their options? I don't think so. Sometimes when you come as the weak part and you have all the support from all the rest of the world, you are not as weak as you portray yourself. And at the end of the day, we have to come equal in our state of mind, I think. And I have many years of negotiations. It's not formal, but non-formal negotiations with Palestinians, and I never felt I felt that people come with their dignity and they come with their beliefs, and I felt very equal to them, and I think that they felt very equal to me. Yes, we are the stronger part of this negotiation, but still the weaker part have his own... He claimed for justice, he claimed for strong things that are not necessarily not evident of weakness. I mean, when you come with a higher moral ground, when I feel many times when negotiating the Palestinian come from this perspective, they don't feel weak.
So very brief, please.
At least as long as...
Yeah, that's okay. Now we are again in the negotiation.
Nur so viel, Björn.
Eye to eye level.
Na, aber ich werde jetzt das wirklich kurz machen. Also erstmal, ich habe kein Problem mit der Aufnahme. Fühlen Sie sich vollkommen frei, das zu tun. Zweitens, ich glaube, Palästinenser und Araber und Moslems, nee, ich würde nicht Moslems, aber Araber insgesamt, haben ihr Problem mit dem Begriff Antisemitismus. Es ist durchaus so, dass es in der arabischen Welt, in der islamischen Welt, anti-israelische Haltung gibt, zum Teil auch vielleicht ganz viel weniger anti-jüdische Haltung, aber das ist nicht unbedingt antisemitisch. Das ist genau das Problem, was eben sehr viele Araber nicht ganz verstehen, wenn es um die Diskussion mit Europäern geht, dass sie sagen, wieso versteht ihr unter Semitismus oder unter Semiten nur Juden? Obwohl wir Araber ja auch, sagen sie, wir sind auch Semiten. Das Phänomen des Antisemitismus ist europäisch, es ist in Europa geboren, es ist auch die Diskussion, die Debatte darüber ist auch europäisch geprägt. Die Araber kennen diesen Begriff nicht so unbedingt. Und wenn man mit ihnen darüber spricht, haben sie meistens diffuse Vorstellungen über Antisemitismus oder über die Geschichte von Antisemitismus in Europa. Aber es gibt wohl anti-israelische Stimmungen, anti-israelische Hetze, anti-jüdische zum Teil Hetze. Aber das hat natürlich mit dem Konflikt mit Israel zu tun, aber nicht unbedingt älter als das. Ja? Oder ganz wenige Phänomene. Ich will das Phänomen nicht verharmlosen. Ich weiß, dass es ein Problem ist, aber man kann die Antisemitismus-Debatte Europas nicht unbedingt auf den arabisch-israelischen Konflikt ohne weiteres übertragen. Und nicht alles, was Israel kritisch ist, insbesondere wenn es von Araber und Palästinenser kommt, ist antisemitisch. Ja, das ist der falsche Begriff, wenn das in diesem Kontext erwähnt wird. Vielleicht mit dem Europäischen und mit dem Verhältnis Europa oder Europäer zu Juden kann ich das durchaus nachvollziehen und akzeptieren und durchaus verstehen, aber nicht, wenn es um den israelisch-palästinensischen Konflikt geht oder um Judentum in Islam geht. Ja, das sind Kulturkreise und Religionen, die eigentlich sehr nah beieinander waren. Und im Islam ist Judentum als solche eine heilige Religion, die respektiert und akzeptiert werden muss. Und es ist anti-islamisch, wenn man Juden nicht respektiert und nicht akzeptiert, wenn man seine Religion wirklich wörtlich nimmt. Im Übrigen, die orientalischen Christen hatten kein Problem mit den Juden. Wogegen die europäischen Christen hatten ein Problem mit den Juden, aber nicht unbedingt die orientalischen Christen. Da muss man auch den Unterschied machen. Ja? Die Orthodoxie im Orient ist eine andere, hat eine ganz andere Tradition als das Katholische und das Protestantische in Europa. Aber das ist mal ein anderes Thema. Wir wollen das nicht vertiefen, aber wenn du willst, wir könnten mal das zu einer anderen Gelegenheit durchaus nochmal vertiefen. Zu der Frage hier vorne, was kann man denn machen, um sage ich mal, jetzt auf gleicher Ebene miteinander zu verhandeln? Das ist schwierig. Wenn die andere Seite nicht davon überzeugt ist, dass man gleichberechtigt ist, dass man Recht auf seine Heimat hat, dass man Recht auf Selbstbestimmung, auf Freiheit hat, ist es ein Problem, die andere Seite davon zu überzeugen. Aber eins ist sicher, und ich kenne es von den Gesprächen, die offiziellen Palästinenser und Israelis geführt haben, sie kamen sich immer vor, als ob die Israelis etwas diktieren würden und sie müssen das entweder akzeptieren oder ablehnen. So ist es von Saeb Erekat zu hören gewesen, aber auch von anderen palästinensischen Politikern. Die Israelis, weil sie die stärkere Seite sind, weil sie das Land kontrollieren, sie können diktieren. Sie können sagen, das ist für uns akzeptabel und das andere ist nicht akzeptabel. Entweder die Palästinenser versuchen vielleicht sie von dem Gegenteil zu überzeugen, aber wenn sie es nicht schaffen, bleiben bei den die Israelis bei ihrer Haltung. Was wichtig ist, wenn es überhaupt zu einem Vermittler kommt, zu einem fairen Broker kommt, denke ich, diese Seite, dieser Staat, diese Staatengruppen muss eben Palästinenser und Israelis gleich behandeln und von den gleichen Rechten auf das Land ausgehen. Nicht, weil die Israelis sind gönnerhaft sind und sie sind großzügig, verzichten sozusagen auf Teil Eretz Israel für die Palästinenser. So ist es nicht. Die Parameter müssen andere sein, dass sowohl Israelis wie auch Palästinenser Recht auf dieses Land haben. Und dann müssen sie eben ein Arrangement finden, wie sie das Land teilen, aber vor allem, wie sie miteinander friedlich leben können. Und das ist das letztendlich das Entscheidende. Ja? Und nicht, dass sie für die nächsten Generationen in permanenter Auseinandersetzung, in permanenten Krieg gegeneinander leben.
Thank you so much. I apologize for the delay. I will finish with two very short quotes, which I think perfectly fit here, which shows that we are somewhere catched between fatalism and optimism. And one is the wonderful quote that is authentically from Theodor Herzl, who said prior to his death, feeling that his time on earth will come to an end, he wrote in a letter to his comrades, "Do not make nonsense while I'm dead." And I think that's a very striking one. And the other one is I have to quote at least one time Konrad Adenauer, because otherwise I'm going to be fired. He had a wonderful quote, which is, "If others think you should have come to an end, you should start over even more fiercely again." And I think fatalism maybe is the worst consultant you can find in the Middle East. So thank you for listening to us. If you enjoyed it, go tell it to others. If not, don't.
Thank you. Run.